content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading in the May 18th, 2018 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows Rudy Giuliani. He's standing on the front lawn of the White House. His left arm is pointing up in the air like he's making a point, making an argument. And then in his right hand, there's a can of gasoline that he's pouring out, and there are fires on the shrubs in front of him and a few behind him. And the title is Rudy to the Rescue. Are Giuliani's incendiary TV admissions helping Trump? And we'll catch up with Mr. Giuliani in just a minute, but we'll start with the main stories and how they were covered. Trump rolls the dice on Iran. What happened? President Trump announced this week that he was pulling the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal. A long-expected but deeply controversial move that dismantles his predecessor's signature foreign policy achievement and may isolate Washington from its Western allies. Denouncing the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action as horrible and one-sided, Trump said the U.S. would reimpose oil sanctions that were lifted from Tehran as part of the accord and introduce additional economic penalties on the regime. Under the 2015 deal, which was also signed by the UK, France, Germany, Russia, and China, Iran agreed to stringent restrictions on its nuclear program and international inspections in exchange for sanctions relief. Trump said the agreement was defective because it didn't stop Tehran from testing ballistic missiles and supporting terrorists, and because some of the agreement's restrictions will expire in 2025. Saying he wanted to negotiate a new and lasting deal, the president warned the Iranians that if they restarted their nuclear program, there would be very severe consequences. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said his government would continue to abide by the deal with the other nations for the time being, but warned that the regime would resume uranium enrichment if the accord no longer provided enough economic benefits. The leaders of Germany, France, and the UK, who all heavily lobbied Trump not to withdraw from the deal, said they were still committed to the agreement. Former President Barack Obama sharply criticized Trump's decision, saying it risked another war in the Middle East. But Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu praised the president for his courageous leadership. Gas prices, already climbing in anticipation of Trump's announcement, were expected to rise further as a result of sanctions on Iranian oil. What the editorial said. The president just brought us closer to war, said the Washington Post. The deal was far from perfect, but it was working. International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors have confirmed that Iran was complying with the restrictions, thus preventing it from developing nuclear weapons. By unilaterally pulling out, Trump is giving Tehran's hardliners the excuse they need to resume uranium enrichment, restrict inspections, and perhaps even race for a bomb. If nuclear activities resume, what can the U.S. do other than take military action? The deal's cheerleaders always overlook its fatal flaw, said the Washington Examiner. It imposes no restrictions on Iran's other malignant activities. As a result, the mullahs are spending the tens of billions of dollars they received in sanctions relief on testing ballistic missiles and aggressively meddling in Syria, Yemen, and Lebanon. Far from moderating the murderous regime in Tehran, Obama's disastrous deal has made it more aggressive, made it a more aggressive destabilizing force. Trump is convinced the pressure of the renewed sanctions will force Iran to accept a better deal, said the New York Times. But Trump has shown no talent for forging deals, only for tearing them up. If the other signatories refuse to reimpose their own sanctions, Tehran won't feel a need to renegotiate. If that happens, there is no obvious plan B. The withdrawal also complicates the president's forthcoming nuclear talks with Kim Jong-un. Why should the North Koreans now believe that the Americans, over the long haul, will honor a deal? What the columnist said. By wrecking one of the most successful arms control deals in modern history, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com, Trump has made his most irresponsible foreign policy decision yet. Iran's leaders would never have agreed to a deal restricting all of its actions, and they're even less likely to do so now, when the alliance against them has splintered. And while some of the agreement's terms expire, it requires Iran to allow intrusive inspections until 2040 and never seek nuclear weapons. Either Trump doesn't understand this, or he was blinded by his obsession with destroying yet another one of President Obama's accomplishments. Obama, and not the U.S., made this lousy deal with Iran, said Brett Stevens in the New York Times. He refused to submit the deal to Congress as a treaty because he knew it wouldn't pass. Trump's courageous decision gives the mullahs a simple choice. They can have a functioning economy free of sanctions and open to investment, or they can continue supporting terrorists and resume their nuclear program. Trump's reimposition of sanctions is coming at an ideal time, said Philip Klein in the Washington Examiner. With high unemployment, inflation, and a currency crisis, Iran has been racked in recent months by protests and labor unrest. The regime may well be losing its grip on power, and reintroducing sanctions could accelerate its collapse. This is nonetheless a giant gamble for Trump, the biggest of his presidency so far, said Gerald Seib in the Wall Street Journal. He's hoping renewed sanctions will force Tehran back to the table or precipitate regime change. But in a conflict with the great Satan, Iranians could instead rally around their government. In a worst-case scenario, the Iranians turn their centrifuges back on, provoking an attack from Israel and the U.S. and leading to a catastrophic regional war. It's always possible the Iranians will back down in response to Trump's pressure and threats, but the president is definitely rolling the dice. And our controversy of the week. Giuliani, is there a method to this madness? Once again, President Trump has proven his genius for picking the worst possible person for any job, said Gail Collins in the New York Times. Former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, just hired as Trump's lawyer and leading spokesman, last week took to the airwaves to defend Trump and wound up making his client look like a liar. First, Giuliani told visibly stunned Fox News host Sean Hannity that Trump did indeed reimburse Michael Cohen, his self-described fixer, for that $130,000 in hush money paid to porn star Stormy Daniels. Up to that moment, Trump and the White House had vehemently denied knowing of the payment to Daniels, let alone reimbursing Cohen for it. Then, on Fox and Friends, Giuliani praised the political timing of Cohen's hush payment, saying, imagine if the Daniels story came out on October 15, 2016, in the middle of the last debate with Hillary Clinton. The clear implication that Trump had an election-related motive for the secret payoff to Daniels, which contradicts the president's claim that he was just trying to protect his family from embarrassment, exposes both Cohen and Trump to charges of violating campaign finance law. Finally, said Heather Digby Parton in Salon.com, Giuliani told ABC's George Stephanopoulos that it's possible other women got a Cohen brokered payoff from Trump. This is Trump's lawyer talking. Let's just say Rudy isn't helping. Giuliani's other big admission may be even worse, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. In his Hannity interview, Giuliani stated that Trump fired FBI Director James Comey in 2017 because Comey would not, among other things, say that Trump was not a target of the Russia investigation. Pressuring an investigator to exonerate a suspect falls well within the boundaries of obstruction of justice. And Giuliani just admitted on national television that his client did just that. Little wonder that Trump later distanced himself from all of Giuliani's comments. Rudy has just started. He'll get his facts straight. In Giuliani's defense, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com, the problem here isn't the counselor, but the client. Critics have mentioned Giuliani's age, 74, and speculated about cognitive decline. But what lawyer could explain away Trump's ever-changing statements about his actions? The president sure does change his mind a lot, said Jonathan Lemire in the Associated Press. And he may already be changing his mind about Giuliani. Insiders say Trump was initially pleased by his old friend's theatrical TV performances, but then realized his admissions were generating negative headlines and breathing new life into the Daniels story. The president has suggested to aides that Giuliani be benched if he keeps setting new fires. There is madness in Giuliani's incoherent defense of Trump, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. But there is also method. Giuliani is actually following the Trump playbook. Confuse, distract, provoke, and overwhelm people's faculties with so many lies, obfuscations, and contradictions that nobody can be sure what's real and what's not. This is a political, not legal, strategy. Like Trump, Giuliani has always believed in waging total war against political enemies, said John Podhortz in the New York Post. Yes, Rudy's made some unforced errors, but the former federal prosecutor's core message was that the Russia probe is a totally garbage investigation which should be shut down. That's why Trump may have hired Giuliani to lay the groundwork for firing Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and or Special Counsel Robert Mueller. It could be a long, hot summer. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for feminine wiles after stripper Veronica Beckham won a legal battle to collect $223,000 left her by the late Mickey Lou, an HBO executive. Lou's family had claimed that as an exotic dancer, Beckham was adept at using coercion and manipulation upon men. It was a good week for Trenton McKinley, age 13, of Alabama, who shocked doctors when he regained consciousness after an accident that left him apparently brain dead. From no brain waves to now walking and talking and reading, doing math, said his mother, a miracle. And it was a good week for devotion. After a Turkish soccer fan who'd been banned from his team's home field for excessive enthusiasm hired a crane so he could watch the game over the stadium walls. That match was very important for our team, explained Ali Dimakaya. But it was a bad week for recidivism after Melania Trump, who admitted borrowing passages from a Michelle Obama speech for her own 2016 convention speech, issued a booklet titled Talking with Kids About Being Online that was nearly identical to a 2014 booklet issued by the Obama administration. It was a bad week for United Airlines, which apologized to passengers for an intoxicated female flight attendant who informed passengers over the intercom that if your seatbelt isn't tight, you blanked up. And it was a bad week for intimidation tactics after the National Hockey League formally warned the Boston Bruins enforcer Brad Marchand that he will face supplemental discipline if he continues his practice of licking opponents' faces during on-ice confrontations. Asked for comment, Marchand said, "It is what it is." And before we leave this page, a short, boring, but important item. Israeli firm spied on ex-Obama aides. A private intelligence firm with ties to the Israeli government secretly worked to gather damaging information on former Obama administration officials in order to undermine the Iran nuclear deal, the New Yorker reported this week. Black Cube compiled detailed profiles of several officials who'd worked in the Obama White House, including foreign policy advisors Ben Rhodes and Colin Kahl. Operatives using false identities also attempted to coax information out of the officials' family members. The firm used similar tactics when it was hired by Harvey Weinstein to stop articles about his history of sexual misconduct. Black Cube was reportedly working for a business client who hoped to benefit from sanctions on Iran. The firm denied the story. The title of our briefing page article is A History of Broken Promises. North Korea has repeatedly pledged it would make peace and abandon its nuclear programs. Is this time different? What is being proposed? North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un has offered to remove all nuclear weapons from the Korean Peninsula in return for a permanent peace deal. At a historic meeting last month with South Korean President Moon Jae-in in the demilitarized zone that has divided North and South since the 1953 armistice, Kim agreed to negotiate a treaty to finally end the frozen conflict. "I came here to put an end to the history of confrontation," Kim said. "It may or may not represent a change of policy." His family's secretive Stalinist regime has a decades-long record of promising to halt its nuclear programs in exchange for sanctions relief or aid. Kim's father, Kim Jong-il, who came to power in 1994 after the death of his father, Kim Il-sung, agreed to end nuclear weapons or missile activities that year. And then again in 2000, 2005, and 2007. Each time, Pyongyang secretly continued its nuclear tests and missile development. The U.S. said then Defense Secretary Robert Gates in 2009 is tired of buying the same horse twice. When did the program start? North Korea began trying in earnest to make a bomb in the 1990s after the collapse of the Soviet Union, which had been a key ally. In 1993, North Korea threatened to withdraw from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty after the International Atomic Energy Agency found evidence that its nuclear plants were producing plutonium bomb fuel. Alarmed, President Bill Clinton sought to cut off nuclear development by negotiating a sweeping deal with the Kim regime, the Agreed Framework. North Korea agreed to halt construction of its nuclear reactors in exchange for the U.S.'s building it two new ones that could not be altered to produce plutonium. But in 1998, Pyongyang began testing ballistic missiles. Negotiations over how to stop that program were ongoing when President George W. Bush took office. What did Bush do? He ordered a policy and intelligence review, which found that North Korea was secretly developing the capability to enrich uranium, another kind of bomb fuel. Bush cut off fuel oil shipments made under the agreed framework, and by 2002, North Korea had pulled out of all deals, saying the U.S. had violated their terms. The U.S. turned to North Korea's neighbors and allies for help. The resulting six-party talks among North and South Korea, the U.S., China, Russia, and Japan produced a new deal, with North Korea promising in 2005 to abandon nuclear weapons and existing nuclear programs. Given Pyongyang's past cheating, Bush insisted on strict verification measures, but North Korea continued to stall on implementing them. In 2006, North Korea conducted its first underground nuclear test. By the time President Obama took office in 2009, North Korea had bomb capability, and the six-party process had broken down. What did Obama do? The Obama administration tightened sanctions while dangling the prospect of negotiations. In 2011, Kim Jong-il died and was succeeded by his son, Kim Jong-un. Just 2 months into the new regime, North Korea and the U.S. signed the Leap Day Agreement on February 29, 2012, which declared a moratorium on missile launches and nuclear tests. But the young Kim was focused on proving his toughness to his generals and to North Koreans, so he ignored that pledge and began testing nuclear bombs of greater magnitude. When President Trump took office with a threat to rain down fire and fury on North Korea, the regime simply redoubled its efforts, announcing breakthroughs in miniaturization of warheads and ballistic missile technology. 9 months after Trump took office, North Korea claimed to have tested a hydrogen bomb, a huge leap in destructive power. 2 months later, it tested an ICBM with the stated goal of delivering a nuclear attack on U.S. cities. But after an exchange of threats with Trump, in which the two leaders warned they could destroy each other's nations, Kim suddenly announced he was willing to negotiate directly with the U.S. president. Is anything different this time? Yes. For the first time, Pyongyang has both nuclear weapons and intercontinental ballistic missiles that can reach the U.S. So it is negotiating from a much stronger position. At the same time, the much tougher international sanctions the Trump administration has imposed have badly hurt North Korea's already weak economy. Trump administration officials are cautiously optimistic that since Kim's overriding goal is to preserve his regime, he might trade his weapons for a peace treaty that provided sanctions relief and strong guarantees that the U.S. would not attack North Korea. Skeptics, however, think Kim is just buying time until he completes the final step in becoming a nuclear power, creating a warhead small enough to fit on an ICBM and sturdy enough to withstand reentry into the atmosphere. Still, President Trump is confident. The United States has been played beautifully, like a fiddle, because you had a different kind of a leader, Trump said. We're not going to be played, okay? Why the U.S. is the enemy? North Korea blames the U.S. for dividing it from South Korea along the 38th parallel after World War II. And it has bitter memories of the 1950 U.S. invasion when American planes burned villages with napalm and U.S. tanks and troops pushed North Korean forces nearly to the Chinese border. As many as 4 million Koreans died in the fierce fighting and bombing, including an estimated 25% of the North's population. North Korea was flattened, said University of Chicago historian Bruce Cummings. The North Koreans see the American bombing as a Holocaust, and every child is taught about it. Ever since, hatred of the U.S. has been a cornerstone of North Korean identity. The regime is organized around the massive military, 1 million strong in a country of 25 million, whose explicit goal is to prevent U.S. invasion at any cost. Anti-U.S. propaganda is a constant, and struggle against U.S. imperialism month is observed every year. Time to read a few of the best columns of the week. The first comes from the U.S. Jonathan Chait from nymag.com writes, Trump's $400 million spending spree. President Trump has made it perfectly plain that he views any scrutiny of his finances as a mortal threat, said Jonathan Chait. He and his defenders have insisted that his personal business dealings are off limits to investigators, a red line that special counsel Robert Mueller had better not cross. We may now know why. The Washington Post just published a detailed investigation into the Trump Organization's business expansion over the past decade, during which the firm began buying $400 million worth of golf courses, luxury homes, and other properties with straight cash. Through much of his business career, Trump had borrowed heavily, often stiffing his creditors. Why the abrupt change in strategy? Eric Trump told the Post it was the result of his father's incredible cash flow. But in 2014, Eric told a reporter, "We have all the funding we need out of Russia." In 2008, Donald Jr. said, "We see a lot of money pouring in from Russia." This, of course, raises the prospect that Trump was money laundering for Vladimir Putin's oligarchs, which would be a crime and could subject Trump to blackmail. Whether Russia has leverage over America's president is not incidental to the Mueller investigation, but it's the very heart. This is from Germany. How should Marx be honored? The birthplace of Karl Marx is thrilled with the larger-than-life statue of the far-left philosopher that was unveiled on his 200th birthday, said Katharina de Moss from Germany. And that's not only because the father of communism is so hip right now, we can milk him for plenty of capital. Trier, the western German town where the co-writer of the Communist Manifesto lived until age 17, is a tourist destination for Marx enthusiasts, and we're selling posters and T-shirts as fast as they can be printed. A group representing German victims of communism has protested the erection of the 14-foot bronze, a gift from China. They blame his ideas for inspiring some of the world's bloodiest tyrants, Lenin, Stalin, Mao, Pol Pot, and causing our nation to be divided into communist East and capitalist West after World War II. Yet Marx, in whose name working conditions were improved and terrible crimes committed, is inseparable from the history of this city. He deserves a statue here. A statue, sure, said Werner Kohlhoff. The author of Das Kapital was a towering philosopher of the 19th century, and anyone who studies globalization and inequality today can't help but admire his theoretical penetration of the capitalist economy. But a statue from China is a bad joke. Chinese President Xi Jinping is encouraging the cult of Marx while his country actually practices a particularly stark form of turbo-capitalism. China now has more billionaires than the U.S. and pitilessly suppresses anyone who dares challenge its ruling elite. Is that really what Marx would have wanted? The slab of bronze kitsch from China is all wrong, said Hennig Hubert in Germany's Deutschlandfunk.de. Marx was a complex thinker who should be pondered over and argued with, not a leader to be placed on a pedestal and worshipped, something understood by Germans who actually lived under communism. During his birthday celebration last week, authorities in Chemnitz, known as Karl Marx City from 1953 to 1990, when it was part of East Germany, brought to life with light and sound the 23-foot-high Marx bust that still sits in the city. The philosopher's lips appeared to move as he denounced the Trier statue as a cheap Chinese knockoff. The head also dared President Trump to get a similar bust made, advising him to suck up to the Russians because they're great with monuments. But 27 years after the fall of the Soviet Union, Marx has become an afterthought and the first country to implement his ideas as a political system, said Aaron Gershkovich in the Moscow Times. Nearly a quarter of Russians don't even know who Marx was, and Russian authorities didn't mark his big day at all. The official stance is that his revolutionary ideas brought misfortune to the Russian people, says Lev Gudkov, head of the Levada Center, an independent pollster. Russians have all but forgotten him. And this from Myanmar. Facebook's role in inflaming ethnic hatreds. The troubling implications of Facebook's global monopoly are at last becoming clear to us here in the West. But we're not the ones most at risk, said John Naughton. The real threat is to developing societies, which lack assets such as a free press or an independent judiciary to check the pernicious influence of social media. Now that its market in the West is approaching saturation, Facebook is assiduously targeting less developed parts of the world, where it often offers free internet connectivity as part of the deal to get its app. The result is that, for many in the developing world, Facebook is now the sole source of online information, and a far from wholesome one. In Myanmar, it was essentially the medium for the anti-Muslim hysteria that led to the ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya people. The ultra-nationalist Buddhist monk Ashin Wiratu, who is banned from preaching to crowds, used it to broadcast his inflammatory propaganda. He compared Muslims to mad dogs and posted gruesome pictures of dead bodies that he claimed were killed by Muslims. The result was a pogrom that killed thousands of Rohingya and sent 700,000 more fleeing to neighboring Bangladesh. Fake news may affect elections in the West, but in the rest of the world, it costs lives. The Last Word article this week is titled, Melania's Separate Life. The First Lady has settled into a quiet routine at the White House, said Mary Jordan, Emily Heil, and Josh Dawsey. She spends little private time with the president, but has noticeably begun to raise her public profile. Donald and Melania Trump's remarkably separate daily routines begin with him getting up around 5:30 a.m., watching cable news shows, and tweeting. The First Lady wakes up in her own bedroom a bit later, according to two close friends of the Trumps. She then readies their 12-year-old son for school, including checking to make sure his homework is in his backpack. Amid the noise and churn of the Trump administration, most recently about how the president paid money to silence Stormy Daniels, Melania Trump has settled into a quieter routine, often apart from the president, raising their son and carving out a place for herself in a most untraditional White House. The First Lady has not directly addressed the affairs that Daniels and another woman, Karen McDougal, said they had with her husband, but she has noticeably begun to raise her profile, independent from the president's, and on Monday launched her formal platform, Be Best. Her focus all along has been children, and this launch is meant to formalize what her role will be for the next 3 to 7 years, said Stephanie Grisham, Melania's spokeswoman. She said that the First Lady would devote the rest of the Trump presidency to the issues facing children today and their well-being. Political marriages tend to be more complicated than most, but it's striking that the Trumps make so little effort to project a more united front. Although both are keenly aware of the power of visual images, some of their memorable moments together are awkward. Melania swatting his hand away on a tarmac, and several times caught on camera seeming to resist his outreach. She is a dignified, private person, and she'll deal with her personal life in private, and it's no one's business, said Stephanie Winston Wolkoff, a longtime friend of Melania's. They are not that couple that holds hands just because. She is old-world European, and it's not who she is. It is unusual to see a candid shot of the president enjoying an unplanned moment with his wife, or even with Barron, the first young son in the White House since John F. Kennedy Jr. in the early 1960s. The Trumps are often apart even during their free time, according to people who know the couple's schedules. At Mar-a-Lago on holidays and weekends, the president golfs or dines with politicians, business executives, and media personalities on the patio, while Melania is often nowhere to be seen. According to several current and former aides, the president and first lady often do not eat together in the White House either. They spend very little to no time together, said one longtime friend of the president. Grisham said the president and Melania do spend time with each other. Aside from the president's solo trips, the family spends most evenings together. She also played down the headlines about Trump's alleged affairs and said Melania is focused on being a mom. She's focused on being a wife, and she's focused on her role as First Lady. And that's it. The rest is just noise. Melania grants few interviews and declined to speak for this article, but during the campaign, she told the Washington Post that she and her husband are very independent, adding, "We give ourselves and each other space." According to several people who know the couple, that space appears to have grown wider under the White House roof, especially since Daniels, as well as Karen McDougal, a Playboy model, publicly talked about alleged affairs with Trump during his marriage to Melania. An awkward exchange happened April 26 with Trump calling into Fox and Friends, announcing that it was Melania's birthday, and then suddenly talking about Daniels. Asked on the same TV show what he had gotten Melania for her birthday, he paused. "Maybe I didn't get her so much. I got her a beautiful card. You know, I'm very busy to be running out looking for presents." According to several White House staff members, Melania has erected a de facto wall between the East Wing, where she is renovating her office, and the West Wing, where her husband and Ivanka Trump, her eldest stepdaughter, have offices. While she goes to the West Wing for official duties, she does not walk down the hall, pop her head in, and see how the president's day is going. "She seldom sets foot in the West Wing," said one person with firsthand knowledge. Yet many political and analysts believe that Trump will need Melania at his side if he wants to win again in 2020. The Trumps have broken the traditional mold of a presidential family from the moment he was sworn in. While Melania stood beside the president at the Capitol, his two ex-wives, Ivana Trump and Marla Maples, sat in the crowd. Trump is the only president to be married three times. Melania is 48, and the president is 71. Rather than move into the White House with her husband, Melania stayed in New York for 6 months to allow Barron to finish his school year there. That delay initially put Melania at a disadvantage, according to a friend who said the rhythm of the White House had already been established and left her out of the mix. Some staff positions from the First Lady's office were diverted to the West Wing, including to support Ivanka, who is a presidential advisor. Ivanka, 36, and Melania, both former models, do not have a close relationship and are very different from one another, several people who know them both said. Grisham said it was not only wrong to say Melania was not close to her stepdaughter, but also hurtful. Noticeably, Melania's presence is growing as Ivanka's fades. Several polls have showed that as she becomes more visible, her popularity is rising. In many ways, the image she projects is the least like Trump's of all the Trumps. The president organizes big rallies. Melania often holds meetings with just a few people. Her husband rails against family-based chain migration. She is from Slovenia, and now her parents, also immigrants, have become legal residents here, too. The president mocks political enemies on Twitter with his derogatory nicknames, such as Crying Chuck Schumer or Cheating Obama. Melania calls cyberbullying an evil and organized a White House conference to try to stop it. Melania has complained that she doesn't deserve the mean comments she has read about herself online. She has been heard saying that she knows her husband has contributed to the combative nature of today's online chatter. And one associate said she has persisted with her anti-cyberbullying efforts, despite White House advice that she pick any other issue to champion. In March, Melania invited top executives from Twitter, Facebook, and other tech companies, along with nonprofits working on internet safety, to the White House to hold a meeting on the issue. "I am well aware that people are skeptical of me discussing this topic," she told the group. "I have been criticized for my commitment to tackling this issue, and I know that will continue. But it will not stop me from doing what I know is right," she said in opening remarks. "We have to find a better way to talk to each other, to disagree with each other, to respect each other." Melania has not always been willing to go in a different direction from her husband. In 2011, when Trump was one of the leading birthers challenging the validity of President Barack Obama's birth certificate, Melania backed him up. "What's this with the birth certificate obsession? Did he ask to see yours when you met him?" asked TV interviewer Joy Behar. "Do you want to see President Obama's birth certificate or not?" Melania responded. She also said what Obama had made public to date was different from a birth certificate. "It would be very easy if President Obama would just show it," she said. "It is not only Donald who wants to see it. It's the American people. They want to see that." But as First Lady, she has publicly praised Michelle Obama and laughed alongside President Obama, who sat beside her at Barbara Bush's funeral last month in Houston. She has also traveled apart from her husband, even when they are going to the same destination. In February, hours after The New Yorker published a story about Trump's alleged affair with McDougal, the Playboy model, Melania did not walk with Trump across the White House's South Lawn to board Marine One. Both Trumps were heading to Mar-a-Lago for the weekend, but instead of making the very public walk across the White House lawn with her husband to the helicopter, she drove separately to the Maryland's military airport to catch Air Force One. Grisham told reporters at the time that given the First Lady's schedule, it was just easier for the couple to meet at the plane. When her motorcade pulled up, White House press aides shouted at journalists to get off the plane until she boarded. No photos were allowed of her arrival. As First Ladies often are, Melania is more popular than her husband. But two friends of the couple say the president, who pays close attention to his poll numbers, also fixates on hers. Her approval rating was 47% to his 40 in a January CNN poll. Trump described Melania to supporters in a recent email as a rock and foundation. "I wouldn't be the man I am today without her by my side," he said. "My beautiful, kind-hearted, and exceptional wife." "They have an unspoken affinity," said the longtime friend Winston Wolkoff, whose official advisory arrangement in the First Lady's office ended earlier this year amid headlines about inauguration spending. Melania has said she sometimes offers advice to her husband, including about his tweets, but that doesn't mean he takes it. During one dinner in the White House in late 2017, Melania told the president that he should be more concerned about the investigation led by special counsel Robert Mueller, and that his legal team wasn't protecting him, according to a person who attended the dinner. Trump disagreed, this person said, insisting that the investigation was going to exonerate him and that he had great lawyers. Grisham disputed this account, saying, "Your anonymous sources are wrong." Since the dinner, two of three lawyers have left Trump's Russia team. Melania is exceedingly close to her parents and her son, Barron, who also speaks Slovenian with his grandparents. When she is out of the public eye, she is often with her family, friends say. Her office declined to say where her parents live, or even whether they keep a room at the White House, as Michelle Obama's mother did. Melania does spend a lot of time in the White House, according to people who work there, and has a very good relationship with the permanent household staff of nearly 100 that includes chefs, florists, and butlers. And she oversees the residence as well as the state floor. Friends say she is a perfectionist who oversees the tiniest details of events in which she is involved. She enjoys putting her personal mark on the historic home and has redesigned the family living quarters. While her husband favors the lavish gold and glitz decor of their Trump Tower penthouse, Melania has picked neutral colors. Still, Trump often waves friends up to the residence after holiday parties or social gatherings and gives tours of the Lincoln bedroom, where he remarks on how tall the former president was while showing off the Gettysburg Address and other features. Melania has, however, told confidants that she wants to keep the residence private. 22 years after her first coming to the United States to model, she is now one of the most photographed women in the world. Paolo Zampoli, who helped arrange for Melania to work in the U.S. fashion industry and sees her in the White House, says Melania is blossoming. "It's an incredible story. It's the American dream," says Zampoli. "She really will become the queen of people's hearts, like Princess Diana was. I think the world will be seeing more of her." This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. We'll read a couple of the items from the Health and Science page this week. First, America's loneliness epidemic. Loneliness is at epidemic levels in the U.S. and could rank alongside smoking and obesity as a major threat to public health, new research suggests. In a survey of 20,000 adults conducted by Ipsos for the health insurer Cigna, nearly 50% said they sometimes or always felt alone or left out, CBSNews.com reported. 43% said their relationships weren't meaningful, and 27% said they rarely or never felt understood. While loneliness is often associated with aging, the survey found that the worst affected were in fact young Americans between ages 18 and 22. Social media use, which some research has suggested can be isolating, has no obvious impact on perceived isolation. "I could have 1,000 or 10,000 friends on Facebook," said Cigna Chief Medical Officer Douglas Nemechek, "but it's the meaningful in-person relationships that I have with other people that actually keep me from becoming lonely." Previous research has shown that loneliness is associated with many physical problems, including inflammation, a weakened immune system, heart disease, and mental decline. One 2010 study found that being lonely has the same effect on mortality as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. Nemechek said the study's finding regarding young people were particularly alarming. "It's something that we, as a society, need to explore," he says. And the health scare of the week, a surge in tick-borne diseases. The number of people with diseases spread by mosquitoes and ticks, tripled in the U.S. over the past decade, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has announced. The agency recorded more than 96,000 cases in 2016, up from 27,000 in 2004. Mosquito-borne viruses include Zika, West Nile, and dengue, while ticks spread maladies such as Lyme disease and Rocky Mountain spotted fever. The numbers on some of these diseases have gone to astronomical levels, said the CDC's Lyle Peterson. The main reason for the rise is higher temperatures caused by climate change that allow ticks and mosquitoes to spread to and thrive in formerly cooler territories. Another factor is globalization. The cheaper and easier it is to travel, the more people end up in high-risk areas. The CDC notes that many more infections will have gone unrecognized or unreported and urges people to take precautions against bites. And we will finish out the show on the Talking Points page, starting with the article, Mueller, Can He Subpoena the President? The slow motion showdown between President Trump and Robert Mueller has entered a new phase, said Philip Ewing in NPR.org. A knife fight over how, when, or whether the two men may meet for an interview. Having initially claimed he'd be happy to answer the special counsel's questions, Trump appears much less enthusiastic of late and says he'll only agree if the terms are fair. But it emerged last week that Mueller has told the president's legal team that if Trump refuses a voluntary interview, he'll subpoena him to testify in front of a grand jury where he'd have no lawyer present. Rudy Giuliani, one of the president's new lawyers, is claiming Trump could ignore a subpoena because of executive privilege. But most legal experts doubt that. When President Nixon refused to comply with a subpoena demanding the missing Watergate tapes, the Supreme Court unanimously ordered him to turn them over. Giuliani also suggested that Trump could invoke his Fifth Amendment rights to avoid answering Mueller's questions. But that refusal would be exploited by the president's opponents as evidence he has something to hide. Trump is perfectly entitled to ignore a subpoena, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. The job of the presidency is too critical for the commander-in-chief to waste time with an investigative fishing expedition. While executive privilege can be overridden in exceptional circumstances, the special counsel's probe doesn't meet that standard. Mueller has produced no evidence of a serious crime, and he could almost certainly gather the information he seeks from alternative sources. On the contrary, said the Baltimore Sun in an editorial, when President Clinton said he was too busy to answer questions in Paula Jones' civil lawsuit, the Supreme Court unanimously rejected his argument and ordered him to testify. And many of Mueller's questions, including what was Trump's intent in firing FBI Director James Comey, only the president himself can answer. The public deserves to hear what he has to say. Mueller may have the law on his side, but not time, said Jonathan Carl in Axios.com. A protracted legal battle over a subpoena would give the president and his allies months to undermine and hamper the investigation. For that reason, Mueller will probably blink first and agree to accept written answers from Trump. If he doesn't, and neither side budges, it could trigger a crisis with dangerous and unpredictable consequences. And a few shorter notes. More than half of NASA's 17,000 employees are 50 years old or older, largely because of the space agency's extremely low turnover rate. About 44% of NASA's workers will be eligible to retire in the next 5 years. The temperature reached 122.4 degrees in Pakistan on April 30th. Meteorologists say that's the highest temperature ever reliably recorded for the month of April anywhere in the world. In April 2017, the Environmental Protection Agency removed an informational page about climate change, a page that had been up in some form for nearly two decades under three presidents, saying the information was being updated. A year later, the page remains unavailable. Republican candidates ran 12,864 political television advertisements from January 1st through April 24th, either mentioning or showing a photo of Hillary Clinton. Only eight Democratic ads mentioned Clinton. If California were an independent country, it would have the fifth largest economy in the world, with a gross domestic product of more than $2.7 trillion. The state recently surpassed the UK and is $700 billion behind Germany. And we've got time for a couple of the quotes today. There's two that I like in particular. The first comes from Zora Neale Hurston, quoted in The Independent from UK. She says, "There is no agony like bearing an untold story inside you." And the second is from Benito Mussolini, quoted in the GlobeandMail.com. His quote is, "If you pluck the chicken one feather at a time, then people won't notice." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.